Welcome to Y2K, the podcast where your host, Amanda Ladino, escapes her existence and subsequent existential crisis into the peaceful portal of films from before the year 2000. This week, we're discussing Jane Eyre from 1943 or 1944, depending on your area in the globe. One of the many book adaptations that cut like half of the book to make the story a cute little gothic rom-com, because we do not have the time to turn this boat around to have an only semi-horrific ending. Once upon a time, a little orphan named Jane was living with her aunt Reed, who punishes Jane and spoils her son because Jane is always running that little mouth off about starving and being cold. Like, honestly, if the little match girl could deal with it, then so can you. Like, Aunt Reed decides to get rid of that drama and sends Jane to Lowood, a boarding school for orphaned and impoverished children, which made me look up, how is she an orphan if she's the ward of Aunt Reed, who's a family member? Turns out, even if you're under the custody of someone, if they're not your parent, like if your parent's dead, you're an orphan, which is like, I feel like we should change that law. Like, that just doesn't make sense to me. I didn't go to law school, but I feel like I went to the school of life. And I know this is a topic on death, but life and death, they go hand in hand. I'm really deep, but, you know, I think whoever does control that particular law, just reach out to me. I've got a few suggestions. Aunt Reed warns the headmaster, Mr. Brocklehurst, of Jane's unnecessary necessities that she's constantly yapping on about. And Brocklehurst, being the gossip that he is, tells all the other teachers and students to shun Jane. But luckily, an angel of a child, Helen, befriends Jane. During this time, the school's doctor, Dr. Rivers, who is not in the book, is nice to Jane and warns Brocklehurst that, you know, bringing the children he's supposed to be caring for to, like, the edge of death may not be the best business model, not really sustainable. One day, Brocklehurst, obviously jealous of the volume of Helen's curls, cuts them off and makes Helen and Jane walk in a circle in the pouring rain as a punishment for their vanity and rebelliousness. That'll be sure to flatten Helen's hair, and she'll no longer be the fairest of them all. You know, unfortunately, they didn't have any mousse or volume products at this time, so you just have to kill the kid, you know. It's not like you can just go to a CVS and get a Revlon airbrush. The times were rough back then. I don't even think they had electrical outlets for that kind of stuff, so. Unfortunately, Helen catches a cold from this and dies, because this is the 1800s. If you are in the rain, you are risking your life. You just kind of have to accept, like, you don't have an umbrella. You didn't come prepared. That's it. Next time, maybe you won't catch your death if you're a little prepared. And, you know, this is why we can't have nice things, Jane. Because whenever Jane gets something nice, we have to take it away. Because, you know, fuck Jane. She's an agent of evil at the ripe age of 9 years old. Dr. Rivers consoles Jane by telling her to get over it and focus on her studies. And we fast forward, and Jane is now graduated and offered a job by Brocklehurst, because he's a hypocritical bitch. But Jane can't help maintain Lowood's cycle of abuse, all for that, and places an ad to be a governess. Jane is contacted by Mrs. Fairfax and goes to Thornfield to meet her. Mrs. Fairfax tells Jane about her pupil Adele, who is the ward of Edward Rochester, the absent owner of Thornfield. One night, when Jane is walking alone in the dark, someone riding a horse who doesn't see Jane because she decided to walk in the dark without a lamp of any kind, which does not comply with OSHA regulations, and she is almost trampled to her death, But luckily, the rider swerves and twists his ankle when he falls and hastily leaves without introducing himself or exchanging insurance information. Jane goes back to Thornfield and learns that the almost-hit-and-run rider was Mr. Rochester, the owner of Thornfield. Mrs. Fairfax suggests that Jane think nothing of Mr. Rochester's abrupt, brisk behavior. It's nothing personal. He has unpleasant, mysterious, unpleasant memories of Thornfield, which is why he's seldom there. Rochester speaks to Jane the next day and is glad to hear that she does not find him handsome, despite his very pleasing forehead that he makes note of. And Rochester and Jane begin to build a rapport. One night, Jane is woken up by strange, maniacal laughter and dashes to the hall to see who is in her room laughing and sees smoke coming from Rochester's room. Jane wakes Rochester up before he's burnt to death, and Rochester tells Jane that it's no big deal. It's probably just Grace Poole, a mentally unstable seamstress that he employs. You know, you call it arson, I call it Thursday. You know what I mean? Yes, that's a Rocky reference. And you'll understand why. This is going to come full circle eventually. Just trust me. Jane feels closer to Rochester after saving him and is hurt the next morning to learn that Rochester has left for a house party hosted by Blanche Ingram, a former flame. Winter goes by without Rochester returning, and then one day there's word informing the workers that Rochester is going to be arriving with Blanche and other guests. Mrs. Fairfax tells Jane that this must mean that Rochester has intentions to marry Blanche. Once Jane meets Blanche and sees how beautiful and rude she is, she's certain of a proposal. Until she talks to Rochester again, and their flame is rekindled. But they're soon interrupted by Mr. Mason from Spanish Town, Jamaica. Jane doesn't see Rochester until late in the night for completely kosher reasons. Rochester just needs Jane to tend Mr. Mason's wound that was caused by, you know, we'll just say Grace Poole, who, by the way, is on the other side of the door. Let's hope that locks holds, because she did bite a good chunk out of this man. So I'll be back. Just sit tight. Rochester returns with the doctor that he sends Mason away with and walks with Jane and tells Jane that he's going to be married. But he will help Jane find a job somewhere else because his bride will most likely want Adele to just be completely sent away to a school and never see her until she's all set and is 18 and then is ready to be married and sent away for good. To woo his potential bride, Rochester accuses her of being a gold digger, and being insulted by this accusation, Blanche leaves. Rochester tells Jane that he found another job for her anyway, and she confesses that she loves him, and feeling good about his chances, Rochester proposes to Jane. At the altar, a lawyer and Mr. Mason rush in and stop the wedding, revealing that Rochester is already married to his sister Bertha? And Bertha is the one that tried to attack Rochester by burning him, and Mr. Mason by just taking a chunk out of his chest, not Grace Poole? Rochester takes a wedding party on a field trip to Bertha's dungeon, and Bertha, not Grace Poole, is shown to be violent and mentally unstable and tries to choke out Rochester. Rochester begs Jane to stay, but Jane tells Rochester that she loves him, but she must leave. Her only option is to return and care for her now ill Aunt Reed until she passes. Somehow, Rochester learned of Jane's connection to Dr. Rivers and finds a way to contact Dr. Rivers to inquire after Jane. Dr. Rivers informs Jane of this, but she asks him not to reply. But then one night, Jane thinks she can hear a tortured Rochester calling her name, and she rushes to Thornfield. And it turns out that she was not hallucinating or being delusional. Mrs. Fairfax tells Jane that Bertha set the mansion on fire, and Rochester was left injured and blind trying to rescue Bertha. Rochester enters where Jane is and hears her voice, and Jane is overjoyed to be back with Rochester, and now that they've got that mansion and wife out of the way. Jane's enthusiasm assures Rochester that she feels more for him than pity, and they'll soon be married and produce another heir. Get it? We are now entering the fax machine portion of the podcast where we discuss facts about the movie. Jane Eyre was released on December 24th, 1943 in England, and on February 4th, 1944 in the US. The movie is based on the Charlotte Bronte novel of the same name. The movie deviates from the book in a lot of places. It does it right away. The movie says that it begins at chapter one, but it actually begins a few chapters into the book. The movie keeps her cousin John Reed, but gets rid of her other two cousins, and it also gets rid of the storyline with Jane's long-lost cousins. A good chunk of the time when Blanche and her guests stay in Thornfield is also nixed out of the picture, which is a positive to me because I don't want to see Orson Welles dress up like a psychic. And the movie swaps out the nice Lowood governess for Dr. Rivers. The book was allegedly about an affair that Charlotte Bronte was rumored to have had with a headmaster while she was a governess, and the School of Lowood was based on a boarding school that the Bronte sisters attended, which gave Charlotte's two eldest sisters TB, which resulted in their deaths. The adaptation rights were originally purchased by David O. Selznick of most notably Gone with the Wind fame. However, in October 1942, Selznick began selling multiple literary properties that he had had the rights to. Selznick sold the completed script and production package to 20th Century Fox. To discuss what had already been set up before the project was sold, Selznick began prep in 1942. And he had already tested Vincent Price, Sir Cedric Hardwicke, K.T. Stevens, inexplicably Gene Kelly, and Burgess Meredith, aka Mick from Rocky, you know, the coach, for the role of Brocklehurst. And I personally would have loved to see Brocklehurst tell the orphans to move your chicken asses. That's a callback to Rocky. It's rough, but I am trying to keep a low profile and not shout move your chicken asses at the terribly late time of 8:50. Katharine Hepburn, Joan Fontaine, and Vivien Leigh were neck-to-neck contenders for the role of Jane Eyre. Alan Marshall, Walter Pidgeon, and Ronald Colman were all considered to play Rochester. Which is funny, well, not funny, but interesting to me at least, because Laurence Olivier, who was married to Vivien Leigh at the time, admitted to imitating Ronald Colman early in his career, and Olivier and Fontaine had just been in the movie Rebecca, which was also produced by Selznick, and Vivien Leigh was also considered for Fontaine's role in Rebecca. If Vivien Leigh were cast as Jane Eyre, her daughter was going to play young Jane. Peggy Ann Garner was originally cast to play young Jane, but then it was announced that the part was reassigned to Margaret O'Brien because the studio wanted a different type. However, in the completed film, Garner does play Jane and O'Brien plays Adele. You might notice, if you blink, you'll miss it. The actress who plays Helen is a little-known indie actress, Elizabeth Taylor. This wasn't Taylor's first movie role. She had two minor roles in There's One Every Minute and Lassie Comes Home before her role in Jane Eyre, which was uncredited. Selznick decided to cast Orson Welles, who had already done a radio production of the film and would do another radio production with Loretta Young as Jane Eyre, 4 months after the movie was released. Welles, who had lost his contract with RKO, was looking to make some money to purchase, develop, and cut the footage that he shot for the movie It's All True. Welles would often try to get funding to have complete creative control of his movies by finding small financiers and using money that he got from acting. Selznick brought on Aldous Huxley, John Houseman, and Robert Stevenson as the writers, the last two who had collaborated with Welles in the Mercury Theater, a Harlem repertory theater formed by Welles and Houseman. Selznick and Welles agreed that it was important to cast character actors who were new to motion pictures, and some of these character actors were Mercury Theater players, such as Agnes Moorehead, Erskine Sanford, both of who were also in Citizen Kane, and Estace Wyatt and Edith Barrett. The movie's composer was Bernard Herrmann, who was also involved with the Mercury Theater. Robert Stevenson was one of the film's writer and was also the film's director, and was a member of the Bronte Society, which is a society that's dedicated to remembering the brilliance of the Bronte family. John Houseman, one of the film's writer, also believed that he would be involved in producing the film, as he was involved in producing in the Mercury Theater. Houseman said on the topic, "I foolishly believed I would then produce a film because Selznick had just made Gone with the Wind and Rebecca, and I believed he was going to take a rest from producing for a while and let me do the producing for his studio. This was one of the reasons I went to work for him. But I didn't know David Selznick. It was absolutely out of the question that he would dream of letting anybody else do anything." Houseman, who claims to have nothing to do with producing the final film, said that he was unhappy when he saw the movie and asked for his name to be removed. His credit on the movie stayed. The production of the movie was very complex and fraught. Houseman, Welles, and Stevenson all heavily contributed to production in different ways. Welles was offered an associate producer credit, which Selznick believed took away from Stevenson's contributions, and ultimately it was decided that so many people contributed that it wouldn't be fair to not list everyone, and they couldn't fit in everyone, so credit to one individual would be waived completely. Moving on to my favorite kind of fun facts, the miscellaneous fun facts. There's been discussion of why Bertha isn't shown in this adaptation of Jane Eyre. Some say it's because the character is more of a metaphor than a person, but the actual reason that she isn't shown is because Aldous Huxley wanted Bertha to be off-screen so that, quote, the inherent menace in the character would be more effective. And also because there was an English censorship on, quote, the depiction of lunacy, end quote. According to his daughter Beatrice, Orson Welles didn't ride horses, which is why any scene with Rochester on a moving horse is a long shot with a double. Welles wore a corset during filming. His third and final wife, Paola Mori, told him when they were first becoming acquainted that she thought he was so handsome as Rochester, and he told her, "You should have seen the corset they had me in," which sounds exactly like Orson Welles. There was also rumors that Welles had directed a few scenes because they differ stylistically with the rest of the film, most notably the first scene and the scene where we're introduced to Rochester. This has never been confirmed, but Welles did seem to have a big hand in production, at least in the hiring process, and Wells was known for having a somewhat brutish, overpowering behavior on set. Joan Fontaine said in regard to Orson Welles, quote, "You can't battle an elephant. Orson was such a big man in every way that no one could stand up to him." End quote. Welles was a very voracious man. He would have passionate love affairs with both men and women. Though the relationships he had with the men weren't sexual, they were very intimate and they'd end in infernos just as passionate as the love. John Houseman and Orson Welles were extremely close in the beginning of Welles' career. Houseman was really known for grounding Welles. Houseman himself was extremely talented and wrote and produced and acted and did voiceover work, but he was often overshadowed by Welles. Welles' talent was too overwhelming to contain. He would burst out with all of these thoughts and ideas, and Houseman would be there to collect and organize them all and deal with the people that Orson couldn't stand dealing with, the execs. Orson started with theater and got along very well with theater because of the lack of dependency on executives. If the financiers withdrew their money, they'd put the show on a bare stage. It was easy to work around a way to show your vision for cheap. And in radio, which Welles also excelled in, most notably in the broadcast of The War of the Worlds, which was a Mercury Theater production, the vision is subjective to the listener of the broadcast, so there's really no possible control over it, so you kind of just have to assume that the listener has the same vision as you. You really can't control, like, the lens that they are seeing it through. But in Hollywood, there is so much money involved in every single step that it is impossible to make anything without sacrificing some of your vision to the executives and the financiers. And Orson must have known this, because when he signed on to RKO, it was because their offer included full control to Orson for his first two films, his first film being Citizen Kane, which he did have full control over. But once Orson lost this control, he took his frustration out on Houseman, and in the final straw between the two, Orson set a tablecloth on fire and threw the blazing table at John. Welles always comes with conflicting stories about the end of his relationships. There's always his side and his opponents, which always seem to vary from their story of what happened and Welles' story of what happened, which he always ends with some way of noting that there's no longer bad blood between the two of them and that he admires them greatly, but they just don't work together anymore. And it'd be nice to think that Welles' point of view was more nuanced and, you know, maybe his opposition just wasn't able to see this point of view and it was all just a big misunderstanding. But what's important to remember is that at the end of the day, Welles is a story creator in every way. He wrote, he painted every day, he directed, he performed magic. He was a true performer who could make mirages that would entertain anyone into fawning submission. He grew up with his mother in a world full of adult artists, and his mother believed and impressed upon Orson that even as a child, if you want to be in a room, you have to bring something to the table. So he'd read to them or do plays at an extremely young age. And as a teenager, he went to Ireland on a scholarship to paint. And during this time, he acted in theaters for money. And he would get cast by claiming to be a big actor in America. So all his life, Orson is really telling stories to stay in the room, to get ahead. He knows how to construct a story well. Because in the end, that's always come down to his survival, is his ability to perform, to entertain, to convince. Orson even made a movie, F for Fake, about the ease of conning or convincing people of the story that you're telling them. That's what conning is. You're convincing someone that what you're doing is the truth. The movie, F for Fake, follows a famous art forgery case and discusses from multiple people's point of view in the case how easy it is to con others into believing what they want to believe. Wells begins the movie by saying that for the next hour, he is going to tell the complete truth of the story. And then Wells dives into another story on art forgery, and Wells reminds the audience that he said he'd be telling the truth for the next hour, and reveals that for the past 17 minutes, he's been lying. To show that under the veil of a captivating story that you want to believe, you too can be as easily deceived, even when warned ahead of time. He also went on the Dick Cavett Show for him to be interviewed and was able to manipulate Cavett into being interviewed by him. You don't really notice it unless you're trying to notice it, but he was very good at pushing his way to get what he wanted in a charming fashion. I'm assuming it was a charming fashion because there was a camera on him. Maybe he'd be a little more aggressive if the cameras weren't on him, I'm assuming. First, he charmed Cavett by saying that he admired him, and then he negged Cavett by informing Cavett that he had heard that at one point, Cavett was an actor, and he wanted to know why, because he always wonders why people he admires greatly were actors. And he presses and presses Cavett until he gets the answer that he wants, and then he asks more questions and presses and presses and presses until he gets his way and gets to have his little interview to interview the interviewer. This is all to say that Orson was a great storyteller, but he was not a great man. He was an egotistical, controlling, disillusioned, wannabe romantic, and you should take his scintillating stories and well-spoken flattery about those who have accused him of brutish behavior with a grain of salt. Let's gallop into the most excellent portion of the pod and discuss my favorite things about this movie. I love Jane and Helen's relationship. Helen is the sweetest, softest soul to walk this earth. Helen telling Jane that she doesn't care what other people say about Jane just proves that Jane Eyre is actually the original gothic Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and in another world, Jane is Rudolph and Helen is Clarice, and she doesn't mind her nose. In this scene, we also get some little cute gothic foreshadowing when Jane and Helen are first talking. Child Jane says that she wants to be loved so bad and would let her arm be broken if it would make anyone love her or let a horse kick her. And when Jane meets Rochester, she is almost trampled by his horse. So cute. Other than Helen, all the characters are so apathetically brutal in their description to each other and of each other. It is so ridiculously hilarious, and I personally would like to utilize this for some good use and suggest using some of these descriptions for your social media bios or dating profiles. I think you're going to get a lot of catches. Here are just a few strong suggestions. Okay, so we have option one, 9-year-old agent of the evil one. Option two, appearance, colon, unprepossessing, character, colon, bad. Option three, you'll find that in many ways Mr. Edward is a strange man. And then we have option four, the most desirable, crusty old bachelor. And I know you're thinking, okay, so I reel him in with all of these descriptions. They're interested. They want to know what's behind the veil. What am I like? What's my first line? What can I say? Luckily, Rochester brings up a good chat-up line to use for your matches, which is, and this is a quote, "Does my forehead not please you?" I think that's a good thing to establish with anyone. Does my forehead please you? Yes or no? That's a good point. If not, why not? Are you about phrenology? If you are, I am not about you, because not great history involved with that. All the actors are pretty much great. Orson Welles is great in this, because of course. Some of his lines are absolutely ridiculous. But when you're already acting over dramatically, as one does in a gothic story, that's just like within the character, you really can't do much about it. There is really not much you can do in delivery to save the lines. Joan Fontaine really nails being Jane and balancing being quiet and respectful of others while also being strong enough to set boundaries and call out rude behavior. She uses a lot of body language with this. She does a great confused face. She also does an equally great "I'm silently pissed off, what the fuck do you want from me now" face. All the child actors are also great. The child actress who plays Adele is also in Meet Me in St. Louis and is so much better as Adele. She's so good at just being like a happy-go-lucky nice kid, even, you know, if her French accent does tend to turn Russian sometimes. And Jane is so supportive and kind to Adele. She's like Mary Poppins, which makes a lot of sense considering that the director and writer, Robert Stevenson, went on to direct Mary Poppins as well as a lot of other famous Disney films of the 60s, like That Darn Cat and Bedknobs and Broomsticks and what have you. The last one isn't a title, I'm just transitioning. Other than Helen and Bessie, the other person who is really kind to Jane is Mrs. Fairfax. She's super sweet, but unfortunately she does look like a walking skeleton that no way in hell could rush to dampen a blanket and wrap Adele in it and then get them both out of a burning building. A funny little detail is that Orson Welles wears a fake nose to play Rochester, but his nose is never brought up as like a significant detail. The fake nose in combination with his eyes and self-proclaimed pleasing forehead does make him look a little similar to Brendan Fraser in the masterpiece Mrs. Winterbourne. And I'm not saying that it's not nice to see a familiar handsome face, but all I'm saying is, you know, maybe add in a, like, "No, sir, I don't think you're handsome because of the shape of your nose," even though it's a perfectly fine nose. On the topic of Rochester, when Rochester rides off on his horse to get to Thornfield before Jane to, you know, basically punk her with a surprise reveal, he was the original Ashton Kutcher of his day. There's, like, something that, like, flies into the air. Maybe it's mud or, like, dirt or whatever you call it. It's like grass, but it's not mud, but it's like a hockey puck of earth. It's just kicked up by his horse, and, you know, I just guess we didn't have the budget to reshoot, but it's kind of funny because, like, whoop, mud. In their first proper conversation, Rochester tells Jane that he had half a mind to ask Jane if she had bewitched his horse with her face that is that of a fairy tale. "Well, why don't you, you coward? Do not threaten me with the good time of bewitching woodland creatures with my otherworldly beauty. You know, I mean, don't ask me twice to carry a candelabra in a castle. I mean, I've been dreaming about that since watching Beauty and the Beast and Barbie Rapunzel. Heck yeah, I want to hear the sound of my heels clacking against stone floor whilst being lit by a candelabra over to a gothic piano. Are you joking? That's only the dream." While still very intense of a character, the movie does soften the character of Rochester much more than the book. In the book, he is a lot more confusing and abrupt, but because the movie really only has the time to focus on the book as a romance, we've got only a little over an hour and a half. So we have got to start laying on that charm fast, or else you are not going to want them to be together in the end. Rochester still does have some of his faults, but they're really quickly recovered. Like, he is mean to Adele when she reminds him of his ex. And just in general, he's pretty mean to Adele when he just constantly tells her to, like, beat it because she's too chatty. But after Bertha sets Rochester's room on fire, he rushes to check on Adele a good 15 minutes later and does regret taking out his feelings for her mother on her. So sweet. For the most part in the movie, Rochester is good at trying to be respectful and trying to show his appreciation of Jane to Jane, but also not really knowing how to properly communicate this because of his sheltered, privileged social setting. You know, he's pulling a Mr. Darcy. That's what's happening. But here's the fumble. Jane mistakenly doesn't use the classic Elizabeth Bennet move of using practicing piano as a metaphor about practicing politeness. So I feel like we could have solved some things earlier if we had just had that chat, but, you know, can't change it now. But Rochester does use the classic 1800s player's move of turning Blanche's sheet music while she plays the piano. And then, same night, by the way, he pulls out all the stops with the tension-filled silent handshake and intense stare combo with Jane. We all know the embroidery circles going crazy the next day. In conjunction with the intense staring, the movie's score and scene pacing is really good at building up the suspense between Rochester and Jane, as well as the mystery of, like, what's in the other wing at the mansion. And on the topic of building suspense of what's in the other wing of the mansion, seriously, the rattling of the door with the music in the background as Jane is tending to Mason is absolutely terrifying. Makes my hands sweat. On the topic of Jane and Rochester, obviously not the previous topic, but just a general topic, I think there is chemistry between Jane and Rochester, but they both show it in different ways. Rochester is very clearly flirting with Jane. He's always leaning in so close to talk to her, like so close. Like, if she turned quickly, she'd take him out. And he's also always making excuses to hold her hand. Like, multiple times he's like, "Are you afraid, Jane? Here, hold my hand so I can tell if you're afraid." That's not a thing. I think she can probably just tell you if she's afraid, and you can go off of that. And Joan Fontaine's face acting makes it very clear that Jane is interested in Rochester, but she's just, like, panicking on the inside when he's around and she has to talk to him. Like, whenever Rochester stops talking and is waiting for her to respond, her face is like, "Okay, all right, Jane, now it is your time to shine. You've got this. Go. You are educated. You can do this." And then she goes, "I don't know, sir." And then you immediately see it on her face and she's like, "Damn it. Fuck. I'm not sure, sir? Oh, you're not sure? Well, you know what I'm sure of? You fucking blew it, Jane. He hates you now. He's disgusted." The costumes are fantastic. I love Rochester's coats that accentuate the waist that Orson Welles is being corseted for. If you're being corseted, you better show off that waist. I am not having difficulty breathing and having my organs rearranged for nothing. Blanche's dresses are beautiful and ornate, but the dresses that I am obsessed with are Jane's. I want all of Jane's dresses. They all have the same perfect silhouette to them. It's like her waist is accentuated too. Like it is snatched. There is nothing. There is nothing between that fabric and her skin. And then the top, the neckline, they have like a separate piece of fabric that is, it's not a V-neck. It is a V that is a V of fabric covering the neck to like the bottom where the waist begins on the gown. And it is like, hey, look, this is an hourglass figure. Do you see this shit happening here? I'm making sure you do. And I also like the character detail that Jane wears Bessie's brooch since the time that Bessie gave it to her, which acts as a way for Bessie to identify Jane once she's older and is like, Bessie, it's me, it's Jane, it's your brooch. Let's bite into the most bogus portion of the pod and discuss my least favorite things about this movie. The book shots kind of take me out of the scenes. I get that it's a callback to the movie being an adaptation, but it's kind of hard to get lost in the story when you keep getting reminded that this is a story that you're being fed. I didn't like that Jane is friends with Helen and then Helen's just killed off because Jane can't be happy and has to wake up with a dead body. A dead body. Waking up to a dead body is one of my many fears that very well could happen, and that is terrifying. One thing that I like, but some people may dislike, is that this is a gothic novel, so at the end of the day, the characters are totally out and left fucking field and do and say the most outlandish shit. It's amazingly bananas. And it's why I love gothic literature, because the characters immediately go to the next level and dig up people's graves to lie next to them, or have the great idea to only walk around outside at night. You know, it's a wonderful, foggy, pitch dark night. Why don't you just put on a nice, cozy 6 layers of wool and wander around the hills that you can easily fall down if you can't clearly see where to step in the pitch dark without a lamp of any kind. On the topic of intensity, when you first meet a person, or even when you know a person, just in general, I do not care how much money you have and how well educated you are and your position in society, do not snap at things to people to indicate them to bring the object that you're snapping at to you. Use your education to be polite. And if you're so goddamn smart, how come you slept through Catching on Fire, you dumb fuck? They didn't teach you how to notice a sudden increase in temperature at whatever fucking boarding school from hell that you went to. And maybe, don't shoot the man that Adele's mother had an affair with and just brush it off as a quick little amusing anecdote. You killed a person, you ended a life. Another outlandish aspect of the story is when Mason is wounded in the chest and is like bleeding buckets of blood, it's not like from a stab wound or, I can't think of anything else, from a stab wound. It's from a bite. So Mason says that Bertha sank her teeth in him. How the hell did she manage that bite? Like, she must have had to get him on the ground, pin him down, and just take a chunk out. Going on with the intense behavior of gothic novels, when Rochester proposes to Jane, it's not a Jane Austen sweet romantic proposal, even though, you know, Darcy's first proposal to Elizabeth Bennet is not sweet or romantic. But Rochester reveals he's not marrying Blanche, but he still pretends like he's still going to send Jane to a new job in a whole ass different country, and she starts choking up, and I felt so upset for Jane when she starts breaking into tears when talking to Rochester, when he asks her, like, oh, why are you sad to leave Lowood? That is the worst feeling to do to someone. And like crying in front of someone when you don't want to is the worst, because first you're sad and then you're embarrassed and then you're angry because you're like, I don't want to cry in front of the person. Now I'm crying and I want to stop crying and now I can't stop crying. It's the worst. Don't do it to a person. Just if they start crying and they're mad about it because they don't want to cry in front of you, maybe give them their space to collect themselves. And then instead of doing this, instead of giving Jane her space or trying to comfort her in any way, he's like, oh shit, I just made her cry. I think maybe now's the time to propose marriage, you think? And he starts like staring into Jane's soul while she's crying. And there's this fucking storm going absolutely bananas behind them. And he keeps saying, say you'll marry me, Jane. Say yes, Edward. Say yes, I'll marry you. Say yes, Jane. Like, dude, she knows her options. Let her speak. You know, maybe she's just choking back tears or trying to catch her breath while in the middle of a storm, while this guy, who's her employer that she thought she was going to have to say goodbye to, even though she loves him, just proposed to her and is like, are you gonna say yes? How about now? How about now? How about now? Like, for a minute, she needs to figure some stuff out. This is a lot. And then Jane says yes, and a bolt of lightning strikes a tree and cracks it open, which is never brought up again. Gothic novels are so wild, man, and they love nature. They love bringing up the intensity of nature. Let me tell you something. The Brontes on those moors having the time of their lives, which were not long, unfortunately. One thing I am glad that they cut from the book is a storyline where Jane is poor and passes out in front of a house, like just a random house, and it turns out that the people in that house were her long-lost cousins. Okay, that's forced. That's, I can believe a lightning hitting a tree, cracking it open, guy is holding his wife hostage, but the house that you happen to pass out in front of, those are your long-lost cousins? All right. And you inherited like $1 million? Okay, sure. The storyline that I felt like the book handled a lot better was Bertha. I feel like the book did such a better job at explaining, not, they aren't clearing Rochester, but explaining that Rochester was forced by his father to marry Bertha, who was rumored to be wealthy, and then he couldn't divorce Bertha because she was a mentally unstable person, and by law at the time, you couldn't divorce someone who was considered mentally unstable. And once Rochester learned that Bertha was mentally unstable, he decided to keep her at Thornfield because the conditions at mental health clinics at the time were horrific. And this is giving him some credit, but maybe he can't have a proper caretaker because they might be legally required in their position to bring Bertha to a mental health clinic anyway, or maybe they're like, I'm not gonna put up with almost being killed every day. I'm a professional, I can do something easier. I don't know. However, this does not mean that he can't keep Bertha in nicer conditions. Like, I'm sure she'll be fine if you put on one light, possibly. I mean, I know she's got issues with fire, so maybe that's why, like, when we see her, she's completely in the dark. But, like, I just want to know if she's comfortable, and maybe we can make her a little more comfortable. Better meals, a bed, with some blankets, maybe. Overall, I feel like the movie is generally well-paced until the last third when Jane leaves Thornfield. I feel like they were kind of scrambling, like they had a rush to get her out and then bring her back in. Time for me to be an open book and discuss what about this movie is comforting to me. I first saw Jane Eyre when I was 11 and was like, holy shit, is that Elizabeth Taylor? The lady from the episode of The Nanny? And then I fell asleep after Helen died. And I woke up during the fire scene and was like, oh, a new movie's playing. Is that fire? Is that man on fire? What is happening? Is this Frankenstein? I've never seen Frankenstein. Is this Dracula? Oh, it's a thriller. Hey now. That dude's moving real close. Okay. All right. So this is a romance. Just a romance where a guy's on fire. Who's that? Who's that brooding tall man with a deep voice? That's staring. Whoa. He's staring. All right. Okay. I'm fine with staring, actually. You know, I've never seen staring like this. What happened to staring? Why don't we stare more? And why don't we shake hands like that? I've never shaken someone's hands like that. And this is love. This is it. This is probably how it's going to happen for me, too. And honestly, if it doesn't, if I don't save a man from a fire and then he shakes my hand really intensely, I don't think that's love. I think that's kind of, you know, we like each other. We own a couch together. For tax purposes, okay, let's do it. But if you haven't saved them from a fire, I wouldn't call it love. And then it cut to a commercial and it's like, oh, in a little while we'll return to Jane Eyre when we're back. And I was like, oh, this is an odyssey. How did we get here, Jane? Who's that man? Is that man the nice guy from the orphanage? Are we still in the orphanage, but like a really nice section of it? Like, I thought you guys were dying of the rain, and now there's a fire, and now there's a handsome man, and we're staring, and did he raise you, and you're shaking his hand like that? That's really creepy. You should get away from him. Turns out, no. They're entirely two different looking men, and entirely two different settings. And then I fell asleep again after the wedding, and I woke up the next day haunted by the memory that I thought I had fever dreamed, and the tall, moody man that I had now had a raging crush on for about 4 days, but had no way of looking up because I did not have a computer, and I was still operating a solid flip phone at the age of 11. And then one glorious day when I did have a computer and I was supposed to read Jane Eyre for sophomore English, I had a little flashback to a hazy memory of child Elizabeth Taylor and a handsome man on fire. And I was like, oh my God, I might not have to read this book because I could just watch Elizabeth Taylor run the show and I can figure this all out in about hour and a half. And I looked it up and I watched it and confirmed that I was not creating my own memories, but it does not exactly go along with the book, so I couldn't use that. But then they were like, you know, we got to move on to the new book anyway, so it didn't really matter at the end of the day. And then even later, like a year ago, I rewatched the movie because I went down a Wuthering Heights rabbit hole, like a really big rabbit hole, read the book, read the foreword of the book, read the inside cover, and then I wrote notes on it, like 70 pages worth of notes with highlighting everything, footnotes. I read articles, watched YouTube videos, I listened to the Wuthering Heights song by Kate Bush. It's amazing. Listen to it now. And then obviously I was like, Emily Bronte's sister wrote Jane Eyre, Charlotte Bronte. So I was like, okay, which sister is better? I have a sister. I am competitive. I want to know, is the younger sister or older sister better? I am the younger sister. I think the younger sister will be better. So I have to watch Jane Eyre to see if the older sister is better. And then when I went to go watch Jane Eyre, I was like, holy shit, this is not better. It's really good, but it's not better. But that is Joan Fontaine and Agnes Moorehead and Orson Welles. They were in this the whole time and I just didn't know it. Like, I'm such a fucking idiot. So I kind of feel comforted by just having a movie that I have watched at different points in my life and noticed different things each time. And I'm kind of interested in, like, when I watch this again and 5 years, what will I be noticing then? So bewitch yourself to the nearest woodland creature and watch Jane Eyre. Thanks for listening, and thanks for joining me in escaping my existence into the peaceful portal of films from before the year 2000. I hope you'll join me in our next episode on My Cousin Vinny. This podcast is released every other Tuesday on all listening platforms. If you like the episode, please rate and review our podcast on your listening platform of choice. Apple Podcasts is preferred, but any support is appreciated. Or you can tell a friend or a loved one, or even a stranger that you think would like the show to give it a listen. Any and all support is appreciated. If you want to keep updated on the pod between releases, or share with us what about the movie is comforting to you, you can catch us on Instagram at @Y2000Pod, and on Letterboxd at Y2KPod. Thanks for listening to Y2K. We love you something fierce. And thank you to Yusuf Kim for our totally rad theme song, and to Bonnie Cohen for our gnarly-ass podcast art.